After several post-Cold War decades of wishing that nuclear weapons would be relegated to the dustbin of history, recent strategic developments, including Russia's nuclear saber-rattling and the expansion of China's nuclear arsenal, have brought the role and enduring utility of the U.S. nuclear arsenal back to the fore of U.S. strategy and policymaking. Here with us to share her insights on nuclear and defense policy and some of her experiences working these issues with allies is CSIS Senior Advisor to the Project on Nuclear Issues and former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear and Missile Defense Policy, Elaine Bunn. I'm your host, Dr. Kathleen McInnes, and this is Smart Women, Smart Power.
This is Smart Women, Smart Power, a podcast that features conversations with some of the world's most powerful women.
So for our Smart Women, Smart Power audience, I first have to start with the fact that Elaine Bunn is one of the kindest people in the defense world and also one of the nation's sharpest minds on deterrence and nuclear deterrence. So an emphatic welcome to you, Elaine. Thank you for joining us today.
Good to be here.
So to get us started, what brought you to the world of defense and the weirdo world of nuclear strategy?
So which of my origin stories shall I tell? I have two.
Okay.
One is, the more interesting one is that when I was 9 years old and my baby brother was born in October of 1962, I was at my grandparents' house and saw President Kennedy come on the TV and talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh.
And I remember thinking at the time, gee, isn't it too bad that my baby brother will never get to grow up because we're all going to be destroyed by a nuclear bomb. Georgia, okay. Actually, yeah, it was that, an atomic bomb at the time.
That'll leave a mark.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm probably remembering that after I actually got into the nuclear field.
Oh, yeah.
So my real origin story is that I did an internship in college with Senator Sam Nunn in 1974 when he was a brand new baby senator. Mm-hmm. And that sort of changed my life in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And I tell him that now. Tell him that often.
Excellent. So to turn to the decision that we're going to talk about today, you had a critical role working with allies and partners on nuclear and missile defense policy when you were, I mean, not just when you've been in the Pentagon, but like when you were in the Pentagon, but outside of government as well. An extended working with allies, it's always extremely, extremely hard. So to set us up, could you share with us, you know, what to you is deterrence, an extended deterrence?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, deterrence is about a potential adversary and trying to convince them not to do something you don't want them to do.
Right.
Pose cost, deny benefits, all those good things that the deterrence crowd talks about. Reassuring allies is a different audience. They're related, but they're not the same thing. It should be that if you can deter your allies' potential adversaries, that should be reassuring. But often that's not enough. And besides, how do you know that you can deter? Lots of people say it's worked all these years. Well, has it worked, or was there just never an intention for major aggression or nuclear use? So it is always difficult to say this or that deterred or did not. It is much more difficult to say to an ally, we really have your back in high-end situations. It's difficult for them to believe.
Well, and to walk back to deterrence, right? Because I think that a lot of the conversation tends to treat deterrence as like a noun, like you sprinkle capabilities or forces in a place and it's a deterrent. And it's like, wait,
no.
Right. So if you could elaborate on that, it's a psychological thing.
Absolutely. It's in the mind of deterrence is in the mind of the potential aggressor. And that depends on all kinds of things, you know, the stakes,
right.
How risk-taking they are, all kinds of things that the same stuff, the same capabilities may deter in one case and not in another.
Yeah.
It's not, here's our SSBN, therefore don't worry, surely it deters.
Yeah.
No, it's a day-to-day and a very different situation for different adversaries.
Yeah.
And that's why the emphasis in the last few decades, I think, has been on trying to understand how potential adversaries think, what they value, how they see various situations.
Mm-hmm.
We will never know for sure.
Right.
All we can do is reduce our ignorance as much as possible.
Well, and then you talked about how it's a different calculation with allies and partners in that the extended deterrence. Why is it so hard?
Because
we have the same sort of thing, like we'll just extend the deterrent umbrella and everything will be fine.
Yeah, right.
Right.
I think you have to go back to the very basics, which hit me one way in graduate school and a different way after 40 years of working with allies on these things. You think about the amazing nature of extended deterrence, that a country, a sovereign country, is giving up a little bit of its own leverage for those most critical, high-end, most awful situations and relying on a different country to provide at least part of that, the nuclear umbrella part of that. And then you look at it from the other standpoint, from the provider of the extended deterrent, and it's, oh my goodness, the U.S. is taking on risk and responsibility for on behalf of another nation and at risk of its own population and
right.
So it's an amazing relationship in any event. And when you go back to that, you think, oh, I can understand why it's so hard for the sovereign nation that is relying on someone else for the nuclear deterrence.
Yeah.
Not for everything. I mean, they have their own capabilities, their own conventional forces. I always say there's what the ally does for itself.
Yep.
There's what we do together, conventional forces, missile defense, all kinds of things. And then there's what we hope those non-nuclear allies will rely on the U.S. for, which is the nuclear part of deterrence.
So why is it in the U.S. interest to extend its nuclear deterrent umbrella? I mean, I can think about, like, the big example that comes to my mind is nuclear nonproliferation. If we didn't do it, there'd be a whole lot more nukes around the world.
Exactly. Well, so yes, for extended nuclear deterrence, I think you hit one of the key aspects of U.S. policy, which is we don't want proliferation even among our allies. New nuclear states can be unstable nuclear states. Anyway,
it's complicated.
It's really complicated.
Complicated.
And you think about the mistakes early in our nuclear history. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's very costly. It's a pain in the rear, but very important, but a pain in the rear. Then you have to go back, I think, even further than that to say, why do we have alliances, period?
Yeah.
It's not just about, we wouldn't have extended nuclear deterrence if we didn't have alliances.
Right.
And why do we have alliances? I think we've gotten unaccustomed to articulating that.
That's
people
true.
Coming out of World War II kind of knew it in their guts. They knew.
Like, better together.
Exactly. And because we do have economic, political interest in various places, and the whole, yes, I know people roll their eyes when you talk about a community of values and democracies and blah, blah, blah. But it's true. There are places where if we weren't already involved, when it hit the fan, we would have to be involved. We found that in World War II.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, and then the set of assumptions about alliances and just the system that we live in now, I think it's just been taken for granted for too long. It's just, you know, it's almost like the plumbing, right? Like it's working fine. We don't need to pay attention to it. But when plumbing goes wrong, things go really, really wrong. You just don't want that set of problems.
You're talking to somebody who just had an HVAC system reinstalled. No, it is, though it's similar, because you've got to manage it all along. You can't wait, have it installed, and then 50 years later, 80 years later, go, oh, wait, there's a little leak over here. Mm-hmm. You've got to be, you need the annual checkup. You need the data, actually not even annual, day to day.
Yes.
Week to week, monthly at various levels. It's constant. Mm-hmm. It's constant.
Well, so when you were in the Pentagon as DASD for nuclear policy and missile defense policy, what were the key issues on the extended deterrent agenda at the time?
Yeah. I came into that office in 2013, so the second Obama term. I kind of missed the first one. My husband died of a heart attack on January of 2021. I'm sorry, 2009. Duh.
I'm sorry.
And so, you know, it was like, I can't do this right now.
Yeah.
I am not in a position to go into the administration in any way, shape, or form.
Sure.
So I missed the first administration. And now I look back and think, great, because a lot of good things happened then that I could then build on
when I did
come in the second one. With allies, for instance, the deterrence dialogues with our allies in Asia, with Japan and South Korea, started in 2010.
Wow.
They, you know, we'd had
really
in NATO high level group we'd had since 1967.
Right.
It's when the nuclear planning group ministerial and the high level group started.
Yeah.
In East Asia, not until 2010. And were they ready for it?
Oh, no. I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
And
that's
so,
pretty late in the game.
And so a couple of very respected predecessors, Brad Roberts among them, had set up these talks already. And the 2010 nuclear posture review had put a lot of emphasis on allies.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you know, we'd worked on all that. I'd been working allies for most of those many, many years in government.
Yeah.
First trip to, I guess, worked the INF negotiations, the intermediate range nuclear forces, deployment of Pershing 2 and ground launch cruise missile. Then we did the eliminate all intermediate range nuclear forces with the Soviet Union then.
Right.
Wow, that was a big, but my first trip to NATO was in 1982 for that.
Sure.
My first trip to Japan was also in 1982 to explain to them one of our proposals that would have allowed the Soviet Union to withdraw all their SS-20s east of the Urals. Guess where those would have been focused? The Japanese didn't like it. And what? We changed our policy on that. We changed our negotiating position.
Yeah.
So that involvement with allies all along while I was at National Defense University. So we'd all had lots of discussions with allies and with each other.
Yeah.
And so I got to support it from the outside and then go back into the Pentagon and do it from the inside.
Wow.
In the second Obama term.
So were you seeing the allies in like Europe and Asia sort of comparing the nuclear discussions or learning from
Absolutely.
Asia? Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Certainly the East Asian allies were looking at NATO and wanting a NATO-like discussion. When I came in March of 2013, I thought, great, I'm going to be able to really focus on allies in Northeast Asia for discussions.
Yeah.
Because NATO, again, it was kind of a management thing. And every once or twice a year, you would go have a discussion at NATO. Then 2014 and the Russian invasion of Crimea.
It changed
the illegal annexation. It sort of changed the discussion.
Yeah.
So then you had a couple of sets of allies in different parts of the world, all of whom wanted more and more discussions about deterrence writ large and the nuclear aspects of deterrence specifically.
Well, on the Asian side, was the tenor of the conversation more about the North Korean challenge, or is it China, or is it all the above?
There were at least two North Korean nuclear tests while I was DASD.
That's a bad way to wake up the
test. Yeah, no, it really was. Yeah, so right. And that does focus. I mean, for South Korea, North Korea is the dominant worry and concern. For Japan, North Korea is a worry and concern, but they were turning more and more to worry about China and China and the East China Sea. And so I guess I would say for the two of them, it was both of the above,
right,
but with different
emphasis. what was the, you know, you're building on these dialogues that had been initiated in 2010, and in 2014 happens, you're really kicking into gear with these big picture deterrence questions that have, you know, again, in the European theater, this is again, dustbin of history kind of stuff. This isn't going to come roaring to the fore. It does.
Mm-hmm.
What were the key objectives for U.S. policy at the time, or what were you trying to accomplish?
Well, in NATO, because of the Russian Crimea situation, there were lots of discussions, and certainly in the high level group, but also at ministerial level, about exactly what did this mean,
right,
about Russia and how Putin saw things.
Right.
And he was, you may remember at the time, even then, he was saying, oh, well, if I had needed to use nuclear weapons, I would have. There were debates about whether there was a nuclear shadow to the invasion of Crimea.
Right.
And so people were, well, some in NATO were trying to re-energize their brains on nuclear issues and Russia.
Yeah.
And then other allies who were now closer to the threat were already very aware of what Russia had been doing even before they went into Ukraine. So I think part of it was to level the playing field within NATO about what do we know, how do we understand it, and is our nuclear deterrent capability fit for purpose now?
Yeah.
Do we need to relook anything? Do we need to look at how we exercise, both tabletop exercises and field exercises? Do we need to relook readiness levels? And
when it comes to things nuclear, like, it's hard to, like, flip a switch, right? It is extremely complicated, extremely detailed stuff. Like, I was talking to one retired Air Force officer who's saying that in the nuclear exercises, they would fly with eye patches so that when the nuclear weapon went off that they dropped, they could switch their eye patch and be able to go home, right? Like, or at least as far as it could make it. Like, because they planned on their eye melting out of their head. It's a different set of capabilities. It's a different beast.
It's different. And obviously the safety and security procedures.
Right. Yeah.
When there are exercises in the field, and we can now say that NATO does this. It used to be you couldn't even talk about
it. Oh, interesting. Okay.
It was the let the sleeping dogs lie.
So sure, sure.
From the late 80s, early 90s, all the way through to about 2014. It was let the sleeping dog lie.
Interesting.
Don't even want to talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah, fair. Fair.
When they do those field exercises, those are not real bombs that they carry.
Oh, right, yeah,
just
yeah, yeah.
To be sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
yeah. It's fully understood.
Yes.
And the U.S. doesn't either. We don't fly around.
Right, yes. That is a very important clarification to that. Yes, absolutely.
These are shapes that kind of feel like, they're weighted like, you know, but they're not.
But the difference in what it means and the responsibility and the requirements, right? Like, the level of detail you have to think through.
Mm-hmm.
And how it's different to how we think of, conventional operations, conventional capabilities. I mean, that one anecdote to me was just this sort of stark reminder of how unique and how different this is. And in a world where, at least to me, it feels like there's assumptions about getting forces to places, and it's almost like Amazon. You can have whatever you need delivered just in time. It's just different.
It's very different. The effects are different. The way they are handled.
Yeah.
The safety, security, surety, very different.
Yeah.
Very different.
Yeah. So moving forward, in the sort of capacity in CSIS and other places. What are the key issues you're hearing or impressions that you're gathering from the discussions on extended deterrence today? Because now we're talking about, you know, what I've heard described as the three-body problem, or basically Russia and China as nuclear peer competitors. And so the conversation, at least as I understand it, is a bit different in the nuclear, in the U.S. nuclear community. How is that?
It is different. And because, you know, first time we've had, China was almost an afterthought when it came to nuclear thinking, and if you can deter Russia, then surely you can deter China. Much smaller set of capabilities.
But it's so different thinking, now.
It's different. And it's not just Russia and China.
Right.
North Korea has not gone away. They've progressed a lot too over the last decade. And then the concerns about Iran and how latent is latent.
Right.
So there are multiple concerns. Mm-hmm. It's not as though the nuclear community ever took its eye off any of those.
But
I think more broadly, the national security community is becoming, as you said in your introduction, it's back at the fore, because the idea that you could have conventional crises or even conflicts with nuclear armed powers, it brings a lot of risks to the fore.
And in this world where we're used to having access to, where we're used to uncontested logistics, we're used to all of these things that have made the projection of military power, I mean, never, it's never easy, but relatively, this is different.
Right. Mm-hmm. This is not Afghanistan. This is not Iraq. This is very different.
Yeah.
And I think we sort of, others will say this, that we, the national security community, focused, we tend to pendulum swing.
Sure.
Let's focus on nuclear, but it's in the terms of nuclear terrorism. That's after 9/11. Okay.
Right.
Then it's, before that it was counterproliferation initiative before that. So the major nuclear powers and worrying about actually crises or conflicts with them, that's a fairly new aha moment for most of the national security community. And for our allies as well. What does it mean? It means when you have a defense strategy that hasn't been for decades two simultaneous wars, conventional wars. And so they see that, yes, we have amazing conventional power that we can surge to a region, but not simultaneously.
Right.
And then it becomes, what is it that they will need to do?
Right.
Certainly initially.
So reflecting on your career, your approach to these incredibly important extended deterrence conversations, do you think your role as your gender as a woman had an impact on the decisions you took as part of that, or the outcomes?
That's an interesting question, because mostly, I mean, I can certainly say that sometimes, especially early in my career, it affected how people saw me. Did it affect my decisions? It may be that personality affects those decisions. How much of that is my being a woman or a mom or a whatever, versus just my personality? I'm big on it's the relationship. Yes, the stuff matters. We've got to have forces that our allies can see, touch, feel, if they're going to depend on us for extended nuclear deterrence. So the stuff matters, but the relationship matters so much more.
Right.
Once you have some sort of baseline, the details of, do you have this capability or that capability, as long as we're confident in it, then I think allies will primarily be as well. So the relationship, the treating allies, especially allies in East Asia who are new as of 2010 to these kinds of dialogues, treating them as mature countries that you talk about the difficulties of deterrence with.
Yes.
It's not the, don't you worry your pretty little head about it.
Right.
Which
right.
is basically how we have treated some allies for a long time.
Sure.
No, they have real security concerns, and we need to talk with them about them with all the difficulties that come with that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it may not be reassuring to say, I can't tell you exactly what a president would do.
Right.
I do believe, you know, we have constantly said the response will be overwhelming and devastating. The decision to use nuclear weapons is one that only the U.S. president can make. Mm-hmm. And anyone that tells you they know what he or she would do is an amateur.
Right.
No, so, and being honest with allies about that kind of thing,
it's authentic,
I think it was more of a, I don't know if it's because of being a woman or a mom, and you see it, you go, okay, you can't tell teenagers or adults, you can't tell young adults, oh no, you don't worry about it, I'll just take care of it. Oh, no, that didn't work.
Yeah.
These are mature countries.
Right.
And they need to be truly involved in their security, what they do for themselves, what we do together, and then what it is that they're depending on us for.
And to wrap up our conversation and reflecting on all of the above, I just wondered your thoughts on what is power and when is it exercised effectively?
I guess quick answer would be power is influence. Mm-hmm. And influence is about people.
Right. Interesting. Yeah.
And so it can be a positive influence. It can be a threatening. It can be a risk of retaliation. It can be various types of influence.
Right.
But with allies, again, that's where the relationship matters. That's where they're seeing the range of views in the U.S. and understanding hopefully seeing whatever the range of views, I have a good feeling that the U.S. will be there for us.
Right.
That kind of relationship building is, that's power and that's influence with adversaries. Sometimes it's not the kind of close relationships that you have with allies.
Sure.
But still, there's a relationship of a country to another country.
Like a physics, like in the physics term, like relationships of
relationships of leaders and all those other levels of people who have conversations and either publicly or privately with them. So I guess I would call it influence.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for this incredible conversation and reminding us, that deterrence is a conversation, and relationships as part of that conversation are fundamental. So thank you so much, Elaine, for joining us today.
Enjoyed talking with you, Kathleen.